Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, a look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello and welcome to Valley Public Radio's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, can Valley communities and law enforcement benefit from the independent review of allegations of officer misconduct and brutality? And after the Fresno City Council recently killed a local bike lane project, does the city's much-vaunted plan to become more bike-friendly have a future? We'll also talk with Joseph Castro, who in just 2 months will become the first president, the next president of Fresno State, the first Latino president of Fresno State, and the first from Central California to hold that office. We'll find out more about his vision for the university. That's coming up later on in our program today. But first, with temperatures already reaching into the triple digits, we begin a new series of special reports on our program that will explore the San Joaquin Valley's heritage, diverse cultures, and economy through that most quintessential summertime tradition, ice cream. To launch this series, which we call Summer Scoop, Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin traveled to Dinuba to tell us how in many small valley towns, the soft-serve dipped cone of Foster's Freeze is more than just a tasty treat. It's a central part of the community.
Fireworks blast into the sky, marking the conclusion of Dinuba High School's graduation ceremony. The celebration soon spills over into the local Foster's Freeze. Bernadette Cochran orders ice cream for her family through the walk-up window.
Hello, ma'am.
Hi. Yes, I would like 3 Butterfinger Twisters.
Okay, junior or regular size?
Regular size.
Okay.
And 1 vanilla chocolate dip cone.
Okay.
Cochran had watched her son's girlfriend graduate that evening and commemorated the event with a trip to Foster's Freeze.
Okay,
that's it.
11:56, please.
She's visited the ice cream shop since it opened decades ago in this small, rural city in Tulare County.
Actually, I was a little frosty when I was in junior high, so I go way back. I'm old.
What is little frosty?
Little frosty is the little ice cream cone, and they had a costume. They had opened up when I was in junior high, and so I got to be the little mascot.
She says Foster's Freeze was the gathering place when she was a high school student. The football players and cheerleaders hung out in the parking lot. She celebrated there following her own graduation.
We used to hang out here in the parking lot and sit on our tailgates of our pickups and have sodas and ice cream.
It feels like a vintage drive-in from the outside. On warm summer nights, people wait for their ice cream in their cars or linger outside the walk-up window. Inside, faded posters advertising ice cream sundaes hang on white and blue walls. Cochran's son-in-law, Kyle Wallace, stands by her side as she waits for her order. He has fond memories of walking from Dinuba High to Foster's Freeze for lunch with his high school sweetheart.
Little restaurants come and go, and fast food's always changing. It's always nice to come and have a kind of a, I guess you'd say, a pillar in the community of a restaurant that you just always come and you know it's there. And
the restaurant hasn't changed since then, and neither has his ice cream companion. She's now his pregnant wife and craves Butterfinger Twisters just like her mom.
Might be some things that change on the menu, but you can always get your ice cream cone.
Across time and culture, food has brought people together. It's the great unifier. And ice cream? It also brings people together, often for sweet celebrations.
It's an experience to go out to an ice cream store.
Robin Davis is the food editor at the Columbus Dispatch and author of Grater's Ice Cream, An Irresistible History. From her research into Grater's, a fourth-generation-owned ice cream company in Ohio, Davis knows that eating ice cream is a festive community event.
It's something that people do not just in the summer, but all year long. When you have a celebration, you have a reason you want to gather, you go to the ice cream shop and you get to look at all the flavors, you get to see what other people are eating. So it really does become, if not a community gathering place, then certainly a place that you want to take your family and your friends.
In the Central Valley, families, students, t-ball teams, and high school graduates can gather at any number of scoop shops. In the region's rural communities, generations have headed to Foster's Freeze, home of soft-serve ice cream with the curly Q top.
Rocky Road Twister?
Foster's Freeze has been around since 1946 and bills itself as a California original. The franchises have been mainstays in small valley communities like Dinuba, Selma, and Sanger for almost that long.
And most people who grew up in California, whether they've been to a Foster's Freeze in the last 20 or 30 years, have a story about Foster's Freeze. Because when they were growing up, it was one of the places to go for a treat. A lot of people have memories about them, and they want to go back.
That's Randy Fritchie, president of Foster's Freeze. He says that over time, Foster's chocolate-dipped cones, banana splits, and shakes have become tradition in rural communities.
The way I describe Foster's Freeze is that we are a chain of mom and pops. So they get the value of the chain with the name recognition, the ice cream, and the buying power. But for the most part, they run their own independent little business in the town or city that they live in.
That's true in Dinuba, where residents treat Foster's Freeze more like a mom-and-pop type of business than a chain restaurant. Sandy Sills is the executive director of the Dinuba Chamber of Commerce.
When something new opens in town, trust me, they're swamped the first few months that they're open because it's something new and different and people want to try it out. But what you'll find is people like to go back to the tried and true.
She says that in small towns like Dinuba, people tend to visit stores where they know the owner and are likely to bump into friends from work, church, or their kids' football team.
I think that kind of tells you about the sense of the smaller communities, and especially the rural communities, and how people kind of think about things. They like the familiar, and they like the things that they went to as a child and the things that maybe their grandparents took them to.
She says Foster's Freeze fits the bill.
I think there's comfort in it's a place that you've always gone, and I think people, even though it's kind of like going to grandma's house, you know, it's not the most up-to-date and modern, you know, classy place, but it's comfortable.
Roseanne Sanchez is as much a fixture of Dinuba's Foster's Freeze as a classic sign outside the shop featuring Little Frosty. She's worked there for more than 30 years, most of that time as the manager.
I've been here so long, you get people move away and they come back, you know, and they're, oh, you're still here, Foster's is still here.
She also says people like gathering here because it feels comfortable. The shop looks exactly how they remember it.
Maybe just the countertops just changed from, because it used to be a lighter blue, they just updated to a little bit darker blue. Everything else is still the same. You get people coming, oh, it hasn't changed. Still the same Foster's.
Lena Alvarez began visiting the shop with her mother and now takes her own family there. After last week's graduation ceremony, she and her daughter Kylie licked matching chocolate ice cream cones.
Oh yeah, I always get chocolate. I don't deviate from my regular. I mean, they have these Twisters, they have the banana splits, they have sundaes and whatnot, but this is what I usually get. This is the best.
Alvarez returns to the shop because she knows she'll see familiar faces behind the counter. She'll also see friends sitting in the red booths inside the shop or hanging out in the parking lot.
The food is definitely good, but I think just people working here, I mean, these people I've known probably for 10 years, they've worked here forever, so the friendly faces, definitely.
Alvarez, as well as Cochran and Wallace, who we met earlier, all have fond memories of savoring soft serve while surrounded by friends and family.
People have enormously powerful connections to ice cream and to where they've eaten it.
Laura Weiss is the author of Ice Cream, A Global History. She says those childhood memories play into our deep-seated love for this cold treat.
Ice cream is much about nostalgia and family and summer and these very strong emotional connections as it is about eating this delicious food.
And as long as the Little Frosty sign is lit up in small communities across the valley, people will likely continue to gather for soft serve and memories. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And you can see photos of the Dinuba's Foster's Freeze on our website, kvpr.org. And throughout our series of reports this summer on the Valley's ice cream culture, we're encouraging listeners and web visitors to join in the fun. You can Instagram or tweet your favorite ice cream photos using the hashtag Scoop89 or share your favorite ice cream destination or memory. You can find us on Twitter at KVPR or email talk at kvpr.org. Joining us now in the studio, we have FM89's Rebecca Plevin and Ezra Romero to talk more about this project. Rebecca, I'll start with you. First, why a series on ice cream in the Valley?
Why not a series? Mm-hmm. No. I love ice cream. And I know I've always seen these stories where these reporters go out and they get to find like the top 10 gelato places. And I always read those stories and think, why aren't I writing those stories? You know, here I am reporting on serious things. And why aren't I reporting those stories? And so I think we originally pitched it as a fun, just fun, let's mm-hmm. investigate ice cream. But as we got into it, we realized that this was a really great way to explore something that everybody loves across generations, across cultures. And it was a great way to look at small communities, diverse communities, to look at our agricultural history, our own community's history. It became a really great way to get to know the Central Valley better.
So tell us briefly about some of the things we're going to be exploring over the next few weeks and months this summer on Valley Public Radio, because this is just the first part in a series of reports on ice cream. Ezra, what are you going to be reporting on?
Well, what I've just – these past few days I've been reporting on big ice cream in the region. So what does that mean? There's two of the largest ice cream factories in the nation and in the world right here in Bakersfield and in Tulare. And so – there's so much dairy and all this milk is flowing through the valley and becoming ice cream and then going around the whole nation. And most people don't know that. So we're going to open people's eyes to the reality of big ice cream, Häagen-Dazs, Dreyer's, and all that. And also to some of the local favorites like Dewar's or Superior Dairy or these places throughout these communities that people like flock to and hold on to.
Rebecca, when you talk to people, you've been out reporting just as Ezra has, and also just in your own ventures around the valley. What do you hear people talking about ice cream? What do they talk about when you bring up the fact that you're doing a story about, let's say, Paletas at La Reina de Michoacan, the great Latino ice cream facility in Fresno? What types of things do they talk about?
Right. So as soon as you start talking about ice cream, people just immediately, this nostalgic look comes over their eyes. I know I've mentioned thrifty ice cream to people, and they immediately mm-hmm. start saying,
yes.
I went there with my grandfather. We get 15-cent scoops. People immediately go to this really happy place. And so it's a really fun thing to talk about. You know, when you mentioned La Reina, when I've interviewed the owner before, and he talks about how when people go and they get to taste the flavors of their own country, how it also brings them back to this nostalgic place. And so that's the great thing about ice cream. I think that's why you hear when you talk to people is it really brings them back to this happy childhood, nostalgic summer memories.
Diversity is so big here in the valley. We have so many people from different cultures. We have the paleta. Tell us briefly what a paleta is. We're going to get into this in another program
yes.
at some point, but it's pertinent to what we're talking about today. This is kind of like a popsicle, but it's a little bit different, I guess. Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a Mexican fruit popsicle, and you can either get them de agua with water or de crema with which are milk based. And the La Reina here in Fresno, so you can get very traditional flavors. You can get traditional fruit flavors, and then there's some crazier flavors, too. And
I saw avocado the other day in a spicy one. I wasn't brave enough to try either of those.
The con chile.
Yeah. And, I mean, I know we've brought them back for the office, and they're always a hit because they're just so – they're delicious and refreshing and just great.
But it's not just the Hispanic culture that has an ice cream tradition as well. We also have Japanese mochi at Kogetsudo in Fresno's Chinatown. There's a lot of things. Is there a way we can look at ice cream and learn something about the valley's diverse cultures, do you think?
Yeah, I think we can also understand who's here and what's represented in each city. Like, there's Basque people in Bakersfield. You know, there's Hmong and Merced in here. What ice cream is represented in those cultures, we're going to find out. And we can find out through you guys coming and talking to us through Facebook and Twitter and sending us your comments and your stories and just chiming in so we know what's out there.
Yeah, and we're hoping to do a story on different cultures, ice cream traditions. And I think, again, it's going to be a great way to taste and savor the multicultural heritage here in the valley.
And the really interesting thing about ice cream is I went to La Reina. I've had their pops before, but I've never actually been to the store out on Belmont, just about a mile east of Roding Park. I went there for the first time this weekend, and it was a great, hot, sweltering day. Had one of these strawberry and cream paletas, and it was really fascinating to be there and see the mix of people at the shop. It's very much a cultural melting pot like you don't see in a lot of other places in Fresno. I understand there's going to be an event that you are helping to put together. I guess you could call it a latter-day or modern-day ice cream social to some degree. Tell us about what's happening Thursday at La Reina.
Well, last week I turned to Rebecca and said, we need to have an ice cream social of some sort. Let's have a tweet up. Let's have a meeting. And so this Thursday night at La Reina de Michoacán, we're going to have an ice cream tweet up. You know, people can come in, tell us their stories about their nostalgic stories about ice cream or paletas or whatever ice cream means to them. We'll record them. They can buy a paleta. They can experience that culture on the cusp between downtown and the Tower District.
It's going to be, because it's on Thursday night, it'll be during Art Hop. So if you're already out hopping, you should just swing by. We'll have great paletas. And even if you're not on Twitter, just stop by, have fun. It's going to be a great time.
And you're going to be recording some of the
absolutely.
The
and so some of those stories could end up on air. They could end up online. We'll be encouraging people to take photos with their ice cream and tag it with Scoop 89 so we can all see them.
So we want to hear people's stories. Where are your favorite places for ice cream in the Central Valley, whether it's in Strathmore or in Bakersfield or Hanford? Everyone seems to have a story. I know some people in Fresno talk about Farrell's, when they used to go to Farrell's when it was in Fig Garden Village, or people in Three Rivers going up to the national parks at Reimers. So there's a lot I think we can learn about the Valley and have fun at the same time this summer with our ice cream series, Scoop 89. Again, Rebecca Plevin and Ezra Romero are two reporters here at the station who are collaborating on this fun summertime project for us. And you can visit our website, see photos from the Dinuba store, the Foster's Freeze story that we heard earlier, and also share your comments again online at KVPR. Rebecca and Ezra, thanks so much for joining us. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Later this summer, for the first time in a generation, Fresno State will have a new president. The CSU Board of Trustees late last month selected Joseph Castro to become the university's eighth president, replacing the soon-to-retire John Welty, who has led the institution for the last 22 years. Castro will become the first Californian to hold the position and the first Latino. He spent the last 23 years in leadership positions in the UC system, with his most recent job being vice chancellor for student academic affairs at UCSF. He's also spent time at UC Merced, UCSB, and Cal. A few days ago, I sat down with Castro at the university's alumni house for a talk about his background and his vision for the campus.
For people who aren't familiar with your story, I want to talk about your background in the Valley. You grew up in Kings County and went to school in Hanford. How did growing up in the Valley shape you as a person that you are today?
Well, growing up in Hanford was just a great experience for me. And what I learned is that the Valley is a unique place. Families are really close here, and what I want to do as president of Fresno State is tap into that unique culture here in the Valley and get as much support as I can from them for the campus and do whatever I can to serve them very well.
Tell us a little more about your background.
Sure. Well, I grew up, I was raised by my mother and by my grandparents. And we lived with my grandparents for a few years. And then when my sister was born, we moved to another place, and my sister actually graduated here from Fresno State with a bachelor's and a master's degree. I'm really proud of her for doing that. And then I went to UC Berkeley through a program that Berkeley started to get more geographic diversity from the Central Valley and from the rural communities. And I was actually admitted to UC Berkeley on the spot at the Ted Wills Center in downtown Fresno, which is kind of coincidental that I'm coming back here to Fresno to lead Fresno State.
You spent 23 years in the UC system. Yes. at Cal, UCSB, UC Merced, UCSF. Tell us about the time that you spent at the UC system. And the UC and the CSU fill different roles in our state's master plan for higher education. How do you believe that experience has prepared you for your service here at Fresno State as university president?
Sure. Well, as you probably know, UC admits the top 12.5% of the student body, and CSU admits more, the top third, and so there's a difference there. However, there's a lot of work that the two institutions do together, and while I have served in the UC system at five of the campuses and at the Office of the President, in every position, I've worked with CSU campuses and with community colleges, and I've always viewed higher education as being kind of one large system to promote opportunities for students. And that's what I bring to the presidency of Fresno State is a knowledge of the whole higher education system, public and private, and the ways in which Fresno State fits into that whole system.
Let's talk about leadership and the philosophy that you have. I know you've spent a lot of time studying university presidents. That's what you did your doctoral dissertation on, as I understand it. What do you feel are the most important qualities in leadership in an institution of higher learning such as Fresno State? And what have you learned from your academic study of what has worked and what hasn't worked?
Well, what I learned in my research is that there's a window of opportunity when a president gets appointed. There's an opportunity for everyone to step back and say, what have we just done? And in the case of Fresno State, we've just had an unbelievably successful 20-year tenure, which is very rare in higher education. The median average is far lower. So to have a 22-year successful run by Dr. Welty is just wonderful, and he and I have spent a lot of time together, and I've tapped into that knowledge. But a new president offers an opportunity for everybody to say, well, what should we do differently, if anything else? And before we do anything differently, I'm going to continue to stay on course and to listen to folks and understand where those new opportunities are. And I think that's what a new president should do, is take the time to understand the landscape as much as possible, get out and listen to the alumni and friends and as well as the folks here on campus before doing any major kinds of actions. And so that's my approach.
You recently announced the launch of your transition team headed by the two CSU trustees from this area, Pete Mijas and Hugo Morales. Tell us about your vision for that body and what they'll be tasked with.
Well, thank you. The transition team is a very important group, and I chose Dr. Mijas and Mr. Morales because of their longstanding experience here in the Central Valley, their knowledge of Fresno State, their position on the CSU Board of Trustees. I think they're exactly the right people to lead this team, and I'm going to use them as a sounding board on lots of different ideas. I'm going to ask them to help brief me on what's happening here. I'll be ready to announce the rest of the membership in a few weeks, but it's going to be a dynamic group, and Dr. Mijas and Mr. Morales are part of that dynamism, and it'll be people from all walks of life, from up and down the valley and even outside the valley. I plan to tap into some unique expertise around California.
This has to be a busy time for you. You're moving. You have less than 2 months before you officially take office here in Fresno. Talk about this, the challenges that incoming president faces and that you're looking at right now.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I've got some things to do at UCSF. I've got some things to tie up there. So I'm doing that while I'm getting acclimated here. And I'll be making some additional trips here. Every day since the announcement of my appointment, I've been working. I've been talking to folks, calling friends of the university, calling faculty and student leaders and staff. So I've been immersing myself in Fresno State, so that beginning August 1st, I'll hit the ground running. That's really the idea of having the transition team, of coming here and talking to Dr. Welty and understanding what's happening so that the transition will be smooth and hopefully people won't even see any beat skipped.
Have you had a chance to talk to Dr. Welty yet? And if so, is there anything you can share with us?
Oh, yes. We spoke right before the announcement last week and agreed that we were going to get together often. One of the things that I learned in my doctoral research is that a lot of new presidents make the mistake of thinking that they don't need to talk to their predecessor. I'm not making that mistake. I spent time with him the other night, and then we got together yesterday as well. We'll get together a few more times between now and August 1st and talk on the phone several times. He's been very generous with his time, and he's just given me his impression of different issues so that I'm not surprised by anything, and I really value that. And his wife, Dr. Brown Welty, she's been so incredibly helpful to my wife and to me as well, and it's been wonderful to spend that time with them.
In the 22 years that Dr. Welty was here, he had a number of initiatives and major areas of focus. I want to ask you about two of those. Number one, diversity and the number of first-generation graduates or first-generation college students, the first in their families to achieve a four-year degree. You can relate to that personally in your story. Tell us some more about how you feel as you will be the first Latino president of Fresno State. What does that mean for those students who may have a similar story, who may have a similar background to you, and how do you feel that issue is of importance today moving forward in your tenure?
It's been heartwarming to hear from students from all backgrounds over the last week and a half, and alumni. I've been hearing from them on Twitter, been getting lots of emails, and it's important to me to be the first Californian, to be the first person from the Valley, as well as being the first Latino to hold office. All of those things I think are important, and I think people are really excited about that, and that makes me happy. I think that provides us with an opportunity to tell the Fresno State story to people that may not have known about it, and I want to tap into that energy and excitement, and I'll be up and down the Valley talking about Fresno State, and if my background is meaningful to the communities, that's great. That's what it's all about. For me, being from the Valley is the most critical asset that I have in addition to the academic credentials, so I'm going to tap into that expertise. You know, I know how to get around to all the different Valley communities. That's going to be really easy for me. I have a lot of friends and other connections that I can build from. So it's just an exciting time, and the incoming president and I met yesterday. He's a first-generation college student from Patterson, and I could tell how happy he was to meet me, and I was happy to meet him, and we shared a lot in common. And I love the fact that I share that in common with so many students. I'm going to be president for every student and every faculty member and every staff member. That's very important to me that I do that, and I'm going to support everyone here.
One last question. Another major focus for the university over the past decade or so has been its involvement in the community. Fresno's not often thought of as a college town, but the university does play a big role in this community, both from engagement of the student body in volunteer activities to the university's attention and focus on economic development and other issues. What sort of role do you see Fresno State playing in the region? How can you and your staff, the faculty here at the university, play a stronger role in fostering change and improving the quality of life in Central California?
Well, engagement with the San Joaquin Valley has been a high priority for this university for many years, and Dr. Welty has led that effort. I'm going to build from that. I think that there are opportunities out there to build from it, so I'm going to spend time with elected leaders. Mayor Swearingen and I have already exchanged messages, and I've spoken to congressmen and assembly and senators, and there's a great deal of support out there from community leaders. I want to make sure Fresno State continues to serve the Valley well. And I think by doing that, Fresno State will benefit because the more friends we have, the more support we'll get, and that will enable us to graduate our students in a timely way and get them out into the workforce where they can continue to contribute to the economy. And I think that's the key to economic growth here in the Valley.
We've been talking to Joseph Castro, the next president of Fresno State. He starts on the job August 1st. Mr. Castro, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to join you today.
And you're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, after the Fresno City Council voted down a bike lane project last month, is Fresno's much-vaunted bicycle master plan on life support? We'll talk to bicycle advocates and one of the people who helped create the plan. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. Stay close.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name's Joe Moore. Last month, the Fresno City Council made a controversial decision to pull funding for a road and bike lane project on Fruit Avenue in North Fresno. Councilmember Steve Brandau, who represents the district, says he parked on the street one day and in an hour saw around 300 cars, but no cyclists, and questioned the need for the $1.5 million project. That move angered cyclists, who said the decision chips away at the city's multi-year effort known as the Bicycle Master Plan. Here to talk more about the future of the plan is Byron Watkins with iBike Fresno and the Bike Happy Foundation. Byron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined on the phone by the man, or one of the people, who helped spearhead the Bicycle Master Plan, former city traffic engineer Brian Jones, who now works for the city of Carlsbad. Brian will be joining us in just a moment. Byron, let's start with you. This move to not implement the Fruit Avenue bike lane. This is in an area that's split between the city and the county. It's been part of the master plan now for some time. Mm-hmm. What does this mean for the future of the plan? This isn't the first time that one of the proposed lanes has been eliminated by city council, but does this cloud the future for the bicycle master plan?
I think it definitely makes it more difficult. It's a little bit discouraging because, you know, you have this plan in place. It's a guide for us to follow. And each time that one of these lanes disappears, it affects the interconnectedness of the plan. What happens is these are pieces that aren't connected yet. And you know, we talk about a lot of riders who are not, you know, people are saying, oh, I don't see bicycles on the road. But one of the challenges is these bike lanes aren't connected yet. And so Fruit is a major part of that connection in order to provide an interconnected bikeway. And by eliminating it, it definitely puts the damper on that.
And we're talking about something, I've heard this term road diet, mm-hmm. and that sounds like something that I don't think it's Jenny Craig for roadways, but
right.
but it's something different, and we've already seen it in a few places in Fresno. And let's see if we have Brian Jones with us now. Brian, are you there?
I am here.
Brian, tell us again, thanks for joining us. First of all, tell us what we're talking about when we talk about a road diet. It's something that we've seen a few times now.
Well, a road diet is just simply reducing the number of travel lanes for motorists and resurfacing and repurposing the roadway so that it's for all users of the roadway. And it can often be done in conjunction with routine roadway maintenance, which was the case with Fruit Avenue, where the county wanted to do routine maintenance on Fruit Avenue in the county islands. And this is a systemic problem that occurs in Fresno because we have county islands within the incorporated area. And so the staff between the city and the county were working really closely to do cross-jurisdictional collaboration, and then you have an elected official that can't collaborate with his board of supervisors that used to hold his seat. And this Bicycle Master Plan is an award-winning document and allowed the city to become an award-winning city. And ultimately, this by enhancing active transportation and improving our roadways in Fresno. This document was to allow help us get off the top dirtiest cities of air quality, help get off the list of the most unhealthy people. Those are the things that Fresno is known for, and by getting people more active and out of their seat of their car and onto their seat of their bike, but you need the infrastructure for people to do that so that they can get connected. We don't build streets that stop and start across county lines and one block after another block, but that's how historically bicycle infrastructure has been done in Fresno, and that bicycle master plan helps, as Byron Watkins was saying, helps connect people from where they are to where they want to go. And this isn't the first road dive that the city has done on Fruit Avenue, but probably 3 years ago, a road diet was done on Fruit Avenue in a few miles south of here, down by Ashland, all the way to the Tower District. And that one, now we see a lot of people riding bikes on the street and where they didn't ride before, and it went by an elementary school and a number of things, and it slowed the motors down by a few miles per hour, which enhances the safety of the roadway. So it is really frustrating to see that good policy was set, and now on specific projects, we don't apply the good policy.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the arguments that I heard in the city council, and you know, Fresno has admittedly a track record on certain projects, usually certain large things, much larger than a bike lane or road diet project, like the stadium downtown or the Met Museum. There's a sort of build it and they will come mentality, and that was one of the things that the council or some members of the city council brought up a few days ago, saying, I don't know that the city should be going in this direction, hoping that we'll get more bicyclists in the future. Byron, what are your thoughts on that? Is that a logical analysis of this situation? I mean, there are a lot of these areas. I can think of Van Ness and Fulton downtown that had the road diet recently. I don't see a lot of cyclists on that road, but then again, maybe there's more than there were before.
Yeah, there's definitely more than there are before. I think I think personally the Granite Park argument is a really weak argument. You're talking about the city getting into bed with private enterprise and being taken advantage of, and we're talking about public infrastructure here, infrastructure that's available to everyone. I think there's a fallacy that when people think of cyclists, they think of a person in Lycra, an expensive bicycle. You know, Baines made a really great voting statement, but one of the things that upset me in what he said was he called bicycles locally a special interest. And I understand, obviously, there's lobbying in Washington and these types of things, but from a local standpoint, a bicycle is not a special interest. We're talking about a bike lane that serves a school. Like, is a 10-year-old a special interest, or a mother who chooses to use her bike to go to the grocery store? These aren't special interests. And I think that you know, this infrastructure is definitely needed and important. And I think, unfortunately, they keep looking at cars. I was at the council vote, and probably 90% of the against argument was really like, well, is this going to create traffic? This is going to create traffic, and there's cars and there's no bikes. But honestly, cars, they keep saying, well, I don't see bikes. But that's the thing, is when you're in a car, if you're not looking for bikes, you don't notice them. But if I'm on my bike and I'm riding, I see bicyclists all the time. And I live on Gettysburg, which was the road diet that was put in just prior to Fruit. And the increase in bicycleship on Gettysburg is tremendous. I see families on cruisers, you know, bikes that you just would never, ever see on the road, riding down the road all the time. Women riding, the type of people that you wouldn't normally see riding on the road or riding on Gettysburg now.
I'd like to bring in some comments from our listeners now online on Facebook. Heather chimed in and said, I would love to see Fresno have even more bike lanes, especially those that are safer. We have some beautiful trails, but there are some gaps in the ability to safely travel and commute between Northeast Fresno and the Clovis side of town and the west side of town and downtown. I would like to see more trails connected and perhaps some additions to existing in-traffic bike lanes that mirror bike-friendly towns like Portland, Oregon. Turning again to Brian Jones, is Fresno, if this bicycle master plan that's been years in the making is implemented and is as envisioned, does Fresno have a chance of being a bicycle-friendly town like Portland?
Right. Fresno is already a bicycle-friendly town. It was designated in 2010 2011, when we finished the Bicycle Master Plan, the League of American Bicyclists awarded the city of Fresno a bronze award for bicycle friendly. Now, Portland is a gold or a platinum, so you know there's still room for Fresno to grow and improve. But it was really encouraging that on our first application, which is and that it has a direct correlation with the advocacy and the people that are riding in Fresno and the number of improvements. In 2010, Fresno led the nation besides New York City in number of bike lanes implemented. And these bicycle infrastructure is a new phenomenon. Long Beach is doing it. San Diego is doing it. Los Angeles is doing it. New York City is doing it. All the big cities are seeing that wherever they make investments for people, not just cars, but for people, the businesses are thriving. Long Beach is doing bicycle-friendly business districts where businesses are seeing their revenues go up. I listened to Jeanette Sadiq Khan, who's the transportation commissioner for New York City, saying that revenues for businesses were going up 75% in New York when they put bike lanes on a street or when they did parklets or made anything better for people on the street and not just the streets for cars. And, you know, it's kind of like when you buy a new car and all of a sudden you see all those same cars out on the street. And when you're in a car, you're driving too fast to often see bicyclists. And that's why giving them space is important. But what I would have encouraged the council member to do is not to sit in a car and look for bicyclists, but to get on a bike and actually ride down the roadway and feel what it feels like to ride next to cars going faster than you. And you don't have any space and being run off the road. And if you can just give some space and make it safer for bicyclists to do it, more bicyclists will do it.
This issue of applying a big planning document, the master plan for bicycles in this case, brings up an age-old dilemma. You spend a lot of money, a lot of time. Brian, about how much money was the bicycle master plan? How much did that cost?
The Bicycle Master Plan was funded by Measure C, and it was about $500,000 effort.
That's a pretty good amount. You spend a lot of time, many years, all kinds of stakeholder meetings. You get this document, but adhering to it, implementing it, is sometimes a messy process, whether it's a bicycle plan or the city's general plan or a downtown revitalization plan. Byron, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on just the challenges of taking what's great on a piece of paper and realizing that in real life when things change, you have different political situations, you have different voting blocks and things that support different interests. Maybe the people who saw some of the earlier road diets are now upset because they have one less lane of travel to drive their car in. How do you see these challenges playing out, Byron?
Yeah, the challenges are great. Blong Zhang, actually, again, he made a great plea to council when he was voting. It was a great speech, and he basically talked about like the right time to do something, and that if he had a button that told him the right time to make a vote on something, that he would have pushed it. But there's never ever been the right time to do anything. And the idea that we have the Measure C funds right now, and these exist, and that we're talking about something that's long into the future. We're making this decision like they're saying, well, right now it doesn't seem like this is right for fruit. That's what Brandow stated. It doesn't seem like it's right for fruit right now. But it is right for fruit right now, and it's going to be right for fruit into the future. And the problem is delaying the vote now only delays this process even further. And I think you know, if we want to see the city become better, we have to start making these decisions now. We have the Measure C money to do it. In order to get Measure C money, we have to have a bicycle master plan. That's all part of it. And that's good for the streets too. This money helps repave the streets if we add bike lanes to the road. And so it's going to see a benefit for the whole neighborhood. And not only was Fruit going to add bike lanes, but it was going to make the road safer on Fruit. It's going to reduce traffic speeds. It's going to make it easier for kids to cross the street, make it easier to make a left turn into your neighborhood. And there's schools in that neighborhood. Less than 10% of kids are riding their bicycle to school now. And we talk about traffic around schools. Well, that's because you are the traffic around school. And if more kids were encouraged to bike to school, that traffic would reduce. And if we give them a safe place to ride, it's an important thing to do.
Another comment from Twitter. This is from Christy online. In a place with a rising obesity rate and poor air quality, there cannot be enough bike lanes if we are still debating the issue. Again, Christy on Twitter today at KVPR. Fresno was just named yesterday in a Forbes article as the dirtiest city in the nation. It's
awesome.
Not the first time that's happened.
Yes.
Byron, what do you think would bike lanes really make a difference? Are we really talking about a measurable dent in cleaning up the air? I have friends who ride to work. I like to ride my bike. But in terms of this big problem, we often hear, well, bike lanes will solve, make a cleaner air. Is that really realistic, or is that just kind of wishful thinking?
You know, I think there's some of that in there. But I think, you know, it's like, you know, if I'm the only one that gets out and rides my bike, I mean, the drops of oil that I'm saving are probably negligible. But at the end of the day, you know, instead of looking at a global scale, I mean, we're always talking about Fresno's air quality. I mean, we talk about it all the time. It's on the news. We're always discussing air quality. People move here and get asthma. And to say, how many people do you know have taken any personal measurable steps to actually reduce air quality in town? What do we do as an individual to actually do anything about it? We talk about it a lot, and sure, government agencies are trying to do things for us, but what as an individual have you ever taken a step to do to reduce air quality? And by choosing not to drive your car and as much as possible or on a particular day, you know, that's a direct contributor to that air quality. And so choosing the bike is definitely something that's going to matter on an individual scale. And the more people that do it, it's definitely going to see – I think it's going to see a measurable impact.
We've been talking with Byron Watkins of iBike Fresno and the Bike Happy Foundation, and Brian Jones, Deputy Transportation Director for the City of Carlsbad and formerly of the City of Fresno. He's one of the ones who helped put together the Bicycle Master Plan. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us today for our conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. In just a moment, we'll talk about the importance of independent review of allegations of law enforcement misconduct in the Valley. That's coming up on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. Last month, the death of David Sal Silva following a beating by Kern County Sheriff's deputies reignited the controversy over citizen trust in law enforcement. Sheriff Donnie Youngblood has since announced that Silva died of natural causes and called the media's attention on the case shameful. Nevertheless, a coalition of groups is now calling for the creation of an independent citizens review board to investigate allegations of misconduct. Joining us now on the phone is Camila Chavez, the executive director of the Dolores Huerta Foundation, one of those calling for the panel. Camila, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. We also have Rick Rasmussen, Fresno's independent police auditor, who works for the City of Fresno and investigates allegations of abuse and misconduct. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
Rick, I want to start with you. In communities that have some sort of independent review, do you see a noticeable increase in trust in law enforcement versus those that don't?
Well, I think that the benefits of having citizens involved in the process is going to increase trust at every level.
And how have you seen it play out in your tenure in Fresno? What have been the biggest challenges that you've faced in terms of investigating various cases? Not to comment on specifics, but what have you seen?
Well, I think that the citizens are starting to see a shift in transparency from what had been a little bit of opaqueness just due to the nature of law enforcement to a system where the actions of the police are more readily accessible to the common day citizen, and that has benefits within itself. The challenges have been obviously starting back up an office that had remained dormant for some time and getting citizens involved in the process, but it's been very exciting and beneficial. We've held a number of meetings with community leaders and addressed issues of interest to them. And I think that's beneficial both to the citizens and to the police.
Turning now to Camila Chavez from the Dolores Huerta Foundation, what would your group like to see in terms of citizens' review of allegations of misconduct?
Well, we are actually still investigating. What do those strong oversight commissions look like? And so we have members of our coalition that are doing just that. You know, online, they're looking at what are the, you know, oversight commissions in San Francisco, Contra Costa, Los Angeles. What are the components that they have that we would like to advocate for So we are still in the investigation process, and also want to speak with community members. We have two members of our coalition that are going to Los Angeles tomorrow to speak with folks there who have just come out of the 10-year consent decree where Los Angeles Police Department have had to implement this type of oversight commission. And so we're just right now in the investigative process, not really sure exactly everything that we want to ask for, but, just trying to see what's out there, what's working.
The Sal Silva case has certainly been front of mind for many people in the last 30 days or so, and it's one of those that has a twisting, winding road, and as the truth becomes more apparent, it certainly becomes more of an interesting story in terms of what we may have initially thought about this case. It's a little more complex, perhaps, but this is not the first case where there have been allegations or concerns about the conduct of officers or deputies in the line of duty. Comment on that if you can. Is this something – are you concerned that there's a trend in law enforcement in the Central Valley, not to single out any agency in particular?
Definitely. And that's what we – we had a press conference last week, and that's the exact message that we were giving, that we believe that this tragic situation – involving Mr. Silva, unfortunately, is not an isolated incident. Rather, we believe that the Kern County Sheriff's Department and other law enforcement have engaged in this pattern of illegal behavior, and particularly against people of color in Kern County. So we are actually calling on the Department of Justice to initiate a civil rights investigation and looking at these cases of individuals who have died while in the custody of law enforcement over the last 10, 15, maybe even 20 years.
Turning back to Mr. Rasmussen now, can you walk us through the process of exactly how you and your office go about evaluating a case? You get an allegation that an individual who's taken into custody was, treated forcefully or abused or beaten in some way. How do you take that from the allegation stage and go through your investigation? And what role do you have? You work for the city. You report, as I understand it, to the city manager, but not to the police chief. How does the investigation process work in Fresno?
Fresno uses an auditor model. It's one of the two most popular models out there, the other being a civilian review board, which is an investigative model. So it's slightly different than what I'm, used to from my other employment. But I look at all the evidence. I look at every document related to the case, every piece of evidence, every interview, and not just what was gathered, but also I look for things that weren't gathered to ensure that something wasn't overlooked, whether it was inadvertent or intentional. Then I do a brief investigative audit and provide my findings to the city manager and the police chief. Actually it goes to one of the deputy chiefs, but the city manager and one of the deputy chiefs in the department simultaneously, so they all know whether or not I concur with the findings of internal affairs. And for the most part, my findings have been similar to that of internal affairs, but not exclusively. I've disagreed on a number of cases, and I think that's the nature of the beast, that there is some disagreement on cases. So far in Fresno, I'm happy to report that the disputes, the disagreements, have been very minor in nature, very nuanced. There hasn't been any case that I've looked at where there's been a wide diverging view between what internal affairs found. But that's the benefit of having civilian oversight. In addition to keeping the citizens more informed and more involved, it also has a side benefit of ensuring that departments are arriving at the right decision from the onset of their investigations, because they're as aware as anyone else that a second set of eyes are going to be looking at the same facts.
You came out with a report a few months ago about the city of Fresno and a variety of cases and had some recommendations. What do you think the city of Fresno Police Department could be doing a better job at? What are your recommendations?
Well, I can report that I got a letter from the police chief last week, and they've adopted all the recommendations that were proposed in the previous report, and that's healthy. You know, it's oftentimes, depending on who's examining the issue, people arrive at the wrong conclusion. You know, a department, an agency, an entity, a business who's been doing business for years and years and years has established a set of guidelines on how they operate. And sometimes it's healthy to have a fresh set of eyes who's not familiar with the background, who ask the questions, well, why do we do this? This seems a little bit out of date, or this seems a little bit uncovered. There's a little bit of wiggle room in here. And something that people who work with it every day don't notice, someone from the outside can look at it, examine it, and it allows self-reflection by the department. And in my case, in Fresno, that's what's occurring as the police have adopted the recommendations that I've made in the last number of reports. I've issued two, and another one will come out in early next month. And so it's been very good, I think, in helping Fresno change some areas that probably hadn't been addressed in decades.
Turning back to Camila Chavez from the Dolores Huerta Foundation, what's the timeline that you're on right now, and where do you see your effort to establish citizens review moving forward?
Well, we know that it's we're in for the long haul, unfortunately. There is resistance on both Sheriff Youngblood and the chief of police. You know, when they were asked about the citizens overview, you know, saying, no, that's not a good idea. However, we have 117 examples throughout the country that we can look to, including Fresno, of oversight commissions and, you know, how they operate. So we know that this is, you know, we have a big, long project ahead of us. And, you know, hopefully, you know, by next year or so, we would have, you know, make some headway on this. And, you know, we also think that there are other components that should be included, which are going to take a long time to develop, such as, you know, training of all staff, you know, everyone who works within law enforcement, that, you know, that there's training related to the use of force, training related to, you know, cultural, you know, sensitivity, that, you know, we can hire, you know, community liaisons, establishment of a citizens' watch group, mm-hmm. you know, how yeah. they coordinate with, you know, law enforcement, those experts that know the policies and practices, and then also, you know, monitoring by outside civil rights groups just to make sure that this is a process that is going well, seeing if there's any, you know, changes. And then I think just a media campaign, because we really need to, as you mentioned at the very beginning of the interview, to reinstate the trust, you know, between community members and law enforcement. We have to work together, you know, and we know that law enforcement, you know, needs our help as community mm-hmm. members.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I have a friend who, she was a social worker. She called on the Kern County law enforcement to help out. Her client was suicidal. Well, they came and shot him in front of her. Now, every time she thinks of a situation where in the past she would have called the police, she's terrified to do so because she thinks, well, you know, she has PTSD, but also yeah. that if I call the police, they're just going to kill, you know, whoever I'm calling, you know, whatever the situation is.
Yeah, well,
so we can't have that mentality.
Yeah, well, building that trust is certainly, I think, something that just about everyone on all sides of the issue can agree upon. Again, we're out of time. Our guests are Camila Chavez, the executive director of the Dolores Huerta Foundation, who's pushing for independent citizens review of law enforcement misconduct in Kern County, and Rick Rasmussen, Fresno's new independent police auditor. Camila and Rick, thank you both for joining us today on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. That's all for our program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org and tweet us at kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.